Hello. On this week's program, we speak with the Irish Tenors, who were in Philadelphia this week to perform at the Mann Centre. Jason Pfeiffer explores the role of the theatre critic. We speak with James Undercoffler. He takes up the presidency of the Philadelphia Orchestra this week. And in our regular exploration of the culture file section at gophila.com, we speak with Bernard Sawinski, the creator of Philadelphia's most visited attraction, the Liberty Bell Centre. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
The Irish Tenors have now outsold even the mighty three tenors, Pavarotti, Carreras and Domingo, and have been playing to sold-out concerts around the world for almost a decade. The original lineup changed in 2000 when John McDermott left for a solo career and was replaced by Finbar Wright. After Ronan Tynan left to pursue his solo career, the search began for his replacement. After extensive auditions and interviews, they recruited Carl Scully, a young singer who had come to their attention initially when they saw him perform at a major sporting event. He had extensive grand opera experience, particularly in Italy, and also portrayed Count John McCormack in the movie Nora, starring Ewan McGregor. I met up with the latest lineup of the Irish Tenors earlier this week, Carl Scully, Finbar Wright and Anthony Kearns. The two originals are Finbar and Anthony, and I just have to ask that since we have a new guy in the group, was there any hazing that took place, any initiation ceremony to bring him in?
It's very early days.
It's still going on.
It's an extensive kind of...
The poor guy's only had to get into the States yesterday. He hasn't been here for a while, and we said we'd have to get over the jet lag at least when we start.
I'm wondering if I should buy a taser or not for these two. Keep them apart.
So, there has been a lot of run-in time for this tour. You've just completed a series, The Irish Tenors and Friends, for RTE Television.
That's right.
In Ireland, and you've completed an Irish tour. Is it all comfortable amongst you now? Are you settled in now?
Yeah, I'm very settled in. Well, I knew Anthony from a long time ago, back from 1994, isn't it? Finbar as well, we had the similar teacher. I mean, Ireland is a fairly small community, especially amongst tenors, and we all kind of knew each other from beforehand. And
all roads lead to Dublin.
That's right, basically, yeah. And we kind of met up in Dublin a few times and got on from there. But I've known them for quite a long time now, and to be singing with them is great, finally.
And was he the automatic shoe-in, or was there a process of finding a new member?
There was a process. Believe it or not, I'd been searching for his number. He'd disappeared out of the country for a while. He went to Italy to study, so I couldn't find a number for him. High up, low down, couldn't find him. Asked everyone, where's Carl Scully? Where is he? So, what we did, we started auditions and interviews and whatnot. So we went through every singer that was able to sing above a G and called himself a tenor. And then we'd gone through the mill and I said, last and final chance, does anyone know where Carl Scully? Some number appeared. I called him. He was in Dublin. He was heading to Kildare to do a gig somewhere.
Yeah.
And I said, get your rear end into the city. I said, we want to hear you before we finish off these auditions.
Yeah.
Because we'd been searching for a while. John McDermott had been filling the place and kindly helped us out over a lot of dates. And then Carl came on board and that's it. So we managed to nab him. And
it was great. It was a bit of a shock to me, really, you know. I mean, I was on my way to a concert, you know, not a care in the world. The next thing, I get a call from Anthony, who I'd actually tried to contact. I didn't have your number either, and I'd literally just returned back to Ireland from Italy. And it was a huge shock to get a call from the Irish Tenors, of course, you know, who are really legendary in the singing world in Ireland.
Well, I mean, around the world, probably the most successful, at this point, the most successful tenor group ever. Yeah.
Well, next to the we'll give the credit to Pavarotti, Domingo, Carreras.
But you've gone on for longer than they.
We have,
yes, I think we have.
Probably outsold them now at this stage. We were on par with the sales at one stage when we started out.
And thank the American audience for that to a large extent, and particularly the Irish American audience who have supported us, you know, through it all, and they still want to hear us, and that's the important thing. And
the music goes on.
Yeah.
The music goes on.
I mean, the music does come on, but how has the dynamic changed? Bringing somebody new into a trio, how has Well, what influence has he had, and what have you had to beat out of him?
The beating will start now shortly after this interview. As you can look at him here now, describing him, folks, over the radio, he's a big lump of a guy. There's a hell of a beating in him.
It's always interesting to hear a different voice. You know, it's like bringing new blood into it. It's always good for the act.
It's refreshing
to have a different voice in the audience that's come along. They're going to hear a different singer. You know, and I mean, Carl, without any question, I think when people hear him, will say he's a great singer. I'm one of the great singers and has a huge career in front of him, I think, you know, over the next 50 or 60 years.
He's a young man. He's 20, he's 27, 28?
27, yeah.
He says he's 27, but I know he's 28 because I've counted up the years and it's just as mathematical. He's 28, right? I was 27 when I joined the tenor.
So there's no woman safe in Ireland.
Not one. Lock up your daughters.
A break from the few weeks that he's here now in America.
No, but it's a great voice. It's a young voice and it's growing and it's developing, and this repertoire he's singing in his sleep, it's easy for him, it's comfortable. It sits when he starts on notes, like if people have to work up to, he just sails in on top notes. It's easy for him.
Yeah.
Great way to be.
Before, when we talked, you talked about the fact that there was a very good, and it was obvious to when you watched you guys upstairs on stage, that there was a very good rapport between you, that you could almost sense that at times people were swapping roles and there was a subtle sort of subliminal conversation going on. Has that continued now with a new member?
I think this will show now on this trip. That's what it's all about. Look, at bottom line is we love what we do. We're very fortunate to do what we do. The music is fantastic. It speaks for itself. So the fun is between us. The camaraderie on stage, people love that. They don't want this. It's like Riverdance. It's the difference between the Irish dancing of years ago and when the likes of Michael Flatley and these guys refreshed it and took the stiffness out of it. And the same is with us. We sing as tenors sing. We have all the notes. We can sing the music. But you have to enjoy it and have fun as well. And people love that kind of naturalness about us. They love the buzz and the crack, and they love to be up. It's like singing among friends. Exactly. They don't feel like it's us and them. It's a party and they're having a ball.
And it's funny, you know, you do, as a singer, as a classical singer, you do lots of concerts and operas and different things with lots of different people, but never before have I ever been with a group where there's never a silence off stage. There's always one of us talking.
So
never silence on stage either. But it's amazing. I mean, when I came back to sing for them the very first time, I just kind of felt, oh, this is nice. I mean, we just started getting on really quickly and very easily, straight away.
That's the way it should be, because it makes it easy for everyone.
Well, you had a baptism of fire, because as you were saying earlier on, we did a 10-part TV series for television in Ireland. You know, and that's a difficult thing to do, because whatever you get away with on stage, you certainly won't get away with in front of the camera, because everything is caught.
Right. And the pressure was on to do it. You know, it delivered in a short window. It was recorded within 8 days, like 11 o'clock in the morning till 1 in the morning. Audiences were passing out. But it had we had 10 shows to record in 10 in 8 days, and it was fairly intense, and you could easily start get scratchy and tear your hair out, but you just put your
12 hours singing a day, which is
it was very easy, it was very comfortable, you know.
There's talk of that series actually coming to PBS later, maybe next year, I think. Can you tell us about some of the guests that were on there and what they did?
We had every wonderful guest you could think
of. We were lucky with the guests we had. I mean, I suppose the big names on an international level, the obvious one is
Andrew Lloyd Webber.
That's how obvious. That's when I went out of jet lag now and all the
age. Andrew Lloyd Webber was probably the greatest living composer in the world today, I think. Certainly the most prolific and successful. Mm-hmm. You know, so we had a special dedicated to him, and he came along and
he played the piano and sang with us.
Yeah,
it was fantastic.
I didn't know he could sing. Isn't he good?
Well, he can't really sing, but
he gave it a go.
He can play the piano.
We had a full show with him, so that was huge in the ratings in Ireland. And considering that the World Cup was a buzz, and RTÉ had the World Cup showing, and the weather was like we've never had it before. The sun, daylight up to 10, 11 o'clock at night, sun splitting the trees, but the show went through the roof with the ratings, which was fantastic.
The Irish Tenors speaking with me earlier this week, just before the beginning of their sold-out 2006 US summer tour.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Newspaper circulations have been falling in recent years, and because of this, many papers have been cutting costs and jobs. Just in the past few months, dozens of writers and editors from the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Daily News accepted buyouts as part of the paper's publisher's goal to reduce the newsroom staff by 16%. Among those who departed were two full-time theatre critics. While the Inquirer will continue to provide theatre coverage, it's apparent the newspaper will not completely fill the void left by the cutbacks. As theatre coverage and criticism in Philadelphia undergoes this transition, Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer decided to take a look at the job of the theatre critic and its role in the local theatre community. Here's his report.
The famous Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw once said, "The power of accurate observation is commonly called cynicism by those who have not got it." While Shaw's claim is debatable, he does make a point in suggesting that giving one's opinion, however accurate it might be, doesn't always go over well with others. Shaw would know. In addition to being a famous playwright, he was also a drama critic in his day.
I think critics are right up there with dentists in the popularity poll.
Toby Zinman is the new theater critic at the Philadelphia Inquirer. She takes over the theater beat after 14 years as a reviewer for Philadelphia's City Paper. Zinman, also a professor at the University of the Arts, comments that even though people in her profession might sometimes be called cynical, jaded, or even vicious, it's not a job she takes lightly.
It's such a brave thing to do what actors do, what playwrights do. You know, you just put it out there, and then I come in, you know, and in a couple of hours I go, pff. And that's really a responsibility. So you can't do that, I think, just blithely.
So what is it exactly that theater critics do? What function do they serve? For starters, Zinman describes a critic as a heightened audience member.
But I think we have to be knowledgeable. I mean, nobody would want me to write about a football game. I just couldn't bring anything to it. I could sit there and look at it, but I'm in the dark. So I think you have to have something to bring into the theater with you.
The need for a critic to have at least some theater background may seem like a no-brainer, yet it's not unheard of for a newspaper to send out, say, a sports reporter who was a good writer, to review a show, because the paper simply lacks a dedicated theater writer. J. Cooper Robb has been a theater critic at the Philadelphia Weekly since 2000. Like Toby Zinman, Robb believes it's essential that a critic knows the art form inside and out.
Theater critics are funny because you just kind of declare yourself one. Back when I started as working for student newspapers, it was just like, I'm a theater critic because I said I was a theater critic. And the reason people would listen and I suppose believe what I said was because it appeared in the newspaper. But I think to be a good theater critic, it's very, very helpful if you've worked in as many aspects of theater as possible. Most good theater critics have a background in theater in terms of working on productions and then also a background in the theory of theater and theater history.
Theater companies have long had a love-hate relationship with the critics. If something complimentary is written, they are quick to publicize the praise. If criticized, they're understandably quick to ignore or downplay the review. J. Cooper Robb admits that constructively criticizing a production was initially difficult for him, especially in a close-knit theater community like Philadelphia, where nearly everyone knows each other. Yet Robb says while he was raised by the philosophy, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all, a critic must operate differently.
It's not my job to promote the Philadelphia theater community, but one of my jobs is to support the Philadelphia theater community. And if by doing that, it's to say that this show is really awful and you should avoid it at all costs, then that's a way of supporting the Philadelphia theater community. You need to point out the bad with the good.
There are those who would argue that the bad is pointed out much more than the good by theater critics. But David Fox, a reviewer for the City Paper, counters that in his experience, most critics are eager to write positive reviews.
They may seem sometimes to be hypercritical of things that aren't as good, but I think you'll never find a more enthusiastic viewer than a critic who loves something. Because all the same things that make us go deeply into things that we feel negative about, I think we then apply to a positive experience.
Fox says while he's thrilled to have opportunities to bring good exposure to a company, he notes that's not his end goal.
I can't say often enough that the theater critic writes for a readership. I would think it's extremely pretentious to imagine that the directors of local theaters or the actors would learn something from me. That's not what I'm there for. If that's happened for somebody, it's great. I'm delighted, but that's not what I'm out to do, and I would never profess that that's what it's for.
Newspaper critics see their first obligation to the readership, but I think it's important that they also understand that they have an obligation to the form.
That's Charles McMahon, artistic director of the Lantern Theatre Company in Philadelphia. He goes on to explain that any analysis provided by a critic should respect all of the components that go into making theatre happen. The director says that even if some aspects of a show do not work well, a good reviewer will thoughtfully analyze the other parts of the production as well, making distinction between elements like acting, directing, design, and the script. Even though all critics might not follow such guidelines, McMahon says he nevertheless pays attention to what they're saying.
You know, some people don't read them at all. I do read them. When the papers come out, I look at the review and I think, how is this going to affect us? Is there some way we can take advantage of what they've said to increase our sales, or is there some way that we can do some damage control if they didn't like it?
McMahon also says that although a review's impact is commonly unpredictable, at least for the Lantern Theater, critic opinions do influence the ticket sales of a production. But not as much as they used to, says actor and Brat Productions artistic director Mady DiStefano.
When there was less going on in Philadelphia, a really knockout review and even the weekly would pack the house, and a good review in the Inquirer would certainly pack the house and maybe even sell out the run. But the Philadelphia theater scene and performance scene in general is growing more rapidly than the audience base is, and so even a good review doesn't necessarily make or break a production anymore.
Even though theater critics may not make or break a production, there remains a widespread sentiment that theater reviews still do carry some weight with readers. When done well, critics are also recognized for sparking healthy and thoughtful dialogue. In short, critics are valued members of the theater community. As theater in the region continues to grow in leaps and bounds, the question that remains is whether or not the quantity and quality of local theater criticism will also grow.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer. Questions, comments, criticisms? Email us, arts@wrti.org. The new president of the Philadelphia Orchestra takes up his position this week. A Philadelphia native, James Underkoffler has been dean of the Eastman School of Music in Rochester since 1997. Orchestra officials cite as reasons for Underkoffler's selection his knowledge and understanding of media and technology, his proven leadership and fundraising skills, and his strong musical and educational backgrounds. Just after his appointment was announced, I met up with James Underkoffler to talk about his plans for the orchestra. On the face of it, you're walking into an organization that's in pretty good shape. You have contracts with your musicians in place, you have a recording deal, you have a national radio deal, you have an endowment that's well on its way to being completed. What's left to do?
Well, this is an orchestra that's ready to go places, to really to redefine the orchestra in the 21st century. It's an enormous opportunity for me to help lead this process. We have a recording contract in place, but there are so many new technologies that need to be addressed, and that's an area that I have an area of tremendous interest and expertise, I believe. Clearly, you know, we have a contract in place, but there's a new one to be negotiated this year, and if we're going to be looking at new ways of doing business and relating to our communities, we need to start addressing those in the contract talks.
What advantages do you feel you bring from academia, and what are the challenges you think you're going to face? Obviously, negotiating with musicians is going to be one of them.
Sure. What I bring, of course, is that I've worked with musicians my whole life, and I believe I know musicians, and I honor and respect them. I enjoy being with them. And that at the Eastman School, we've really been looking at how musicians will need to operate in the future and equipping them to do that. So I've been in touch with the innovations that are out there and also looking beyond. It's pretty obvious I haven't negotiated a musician's collective bargaining agreement, but in my past I've certainly done that with a teacher's union, and I've managed that, so look forward to learning to do that.
There is a school of thought out there that says orchestras don't really need to engage with young people, that let them grow up and they'll eventually find their way to symphonic music, and we don't need to get into all these techno gadgets and bells and whistles to try and repackage what is actually a very, very good and very enduring product.
Well, I certainly don't agree with that at all. It's interesting to me because when I grew up, classical music was considered essentially the top of the pyramid. It was assumed that young people would gravitate to the top of that pyramid as they matured in their lives, and this just isn't so anymore. There's been a flattening of that pyramid, and there are so many musical genres available to people, and we've got to get in there. This is the most extraordinary music in the world, and we've got to get it in front of people and get young people involved. I want to see them walking down the street with their iPods tuned into the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Final question. This is something Meister Eschenbach has covered many times, that he wants to try and get away from a certain element of the fear factor of coming into a concert hall, that you need to know how to behave. You need to come armed with a great deal of knowledge. And then you're sitting looking at these people in very formal clothing. in a very formal setting that hasn't changed for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on changing the actual concert experience?
Well, I talked about this with the musicians and with the search committee, that we need to develop different presentational formats so that people become comfortable with the concert experience. But just commenting directly on what you just said, I found that even those people who are in the concert hall are very curious about what the music's all about. You know, they've learned how to dress up and do the thing, but they're really interested. And so educational programs of different shapes and sizes, even for the veteran concert goer, are very popular.
James Onderkoffler, the new president of the Philadelphia Orchestra, who begins work this week. Now it's time for our regular perusal of the Culture File section of gophila.com. The most visited tourist attraction in Philadelphia is, not surprisingly, the Liberty Bell Center. The bell was moved from a pavilion on Market Street, where it had resided since the bicentennial, to its new home on 6th Street between Market and Chestnut Streets in October 2003. The Liberty Bell Center incorporates three discrete but physically and thematically connected elements: a shaded outdoor arcade containing educational materials, an inside interpretive exhibit hall, and a new chamber for the bell. The architect for the project was Philadelphia native Bernard Sawinski of Boland Sawinski Jackson.
The design process, by its nature, puts the architect in the role of a visitor. When we started out assimilating the ingredients of the center with its exhibitry, with its needs for clarity of circulation, for its staffing requirements, everything that goes into a building of this nature, you always put yourself in the position of a first-time visitor to experience this in a way that enhances that potential. What is unique about the building is that it's what we call a one-way building. You enter at the north end, you go through an exhibit, you arrive at the bell for what is the consummate experience of you and the bell in silence, and then move on to further experiences to the south as you exit. That allowed the building to have a very simple diagram of how people would use it. Visitors come in all shapes and sizes and intellectual curiosity. Some people want their picture by the bell and get on the bus, so that's what we call the three-minute visitor. But there are other guests that come to visit who are interested in the finest detail, and they may stay there for an hour poring over the text and the artifacts and the exhibitry, and come to the bell and ponder its significance based on that exposure. So we constructed what we called the fast lane and the slow lane, so to meet these two extremes of the agenda. And you can imagine people with a mixed interest can pick their path in between the two. So on one hand, it's a very serious journey, and one could learn a great deal about history and the significance of the bell. But one can also take it as a visit of great pleasure and still get the message of its importance. The way this fast lane, slow lane works is that in the organization of the building, we introduced a undulating stone wall whose purpose was in the building to separate open spaces from enclosed spaces like the multipurpose room or the special area for the Park Service, and to guide you from one set of exhibits to another to reach the ultimate destination and then out again into the landscape, so that as a visitor you can easily acclimate yourself to the opportunities. By the building being as transparent as it is, one could begin to understand the building just by walking the lawn outside. And there was a desire on our part to make this a kind of 24/7 pavilion, that at night when the building was closed, that it would be lit and people could walk in the lawn and see the artifacts and the bell from this vantage point out on the lawn. All these things came together to define the enclosure of the building and the nature of this great stone wall that came through. Why is it a stone wall at all? Because we were interested in resonating with the materials and the detailing of the hall as a part of the instincts for the new building or the inspiration for the new building. And as you know, the coins or the corners of Independence Hall are trimmed in the stone. It's called Chelmsford granite, and it's a American granite from Vermont that we used on our wall as well. So there's a harmony of using those two. We also use the same brick bonding arrangement. There's a Flemish bond is a pattern of bricks that deal with long and short bricks, to be simplistic about it. That is the way the facade of the hall is constructed. We use the same Flemish bond on our brickwork, and even down to the detail of the mortar that holds the bricks together, they use what is called a grapevine tooling, which is how the shape of the mortar between bricks. And it provides for a nice light seam of mortar with a shadow line in that, which makes it for a very elegant wall. We use that same detail in the new building. So we have a building that resonates with the authenticity of the past, the craft of the past, but also uses it in new and modern ways that can bring into the total equation contemporary needs for environmental controls and viewing flexibility and all those other criteria that one runs into. As I walk through the building, it's always a pleasure to see how people, where they stop, what they talk about when they're viewing the different exhibits, how fast they move through the exhibits, what happens at the threshold of the encounter to the bell, and what happens right at the bell. And it changes day to day and crowd to crowd, because on a school day, it's a very exciting, stimulating place, and kids are wired. You know, they're running around, they're having a good time, and they are connected with all of this. But it's very interesting at the when they reach the bell, after they have this story around them, they learn by osmosis and reading that they stand at the foot of the bell. There's a magnetic distance between you and the bell that you automatically stop at a given point in the chamber. The chamber is composed of a low, I'll call it an introductory space, and then it blossoms into this large volume that centers on the on which the bell is centered. And people stay right at that edge between the low and the high space and look at the bell.
Architect Bernard Sewinski of Boland Sewinski Jackson, the creator of the Liberty Bell Center in Philadelphia. More information on the Liberty Bell Center is available at the Culture Files section of gophila.com. And that's our program for this week. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.